today on Compassion Radio.
How do you deal with the naysayers out there that think you're foolish for stepping into something that seems a waste of energy and resources and lives?
We're generally able to say to those folks, this is what we believe God has asked us to do. He's made the way clear. He's opened doors. We may not have even been looking for an opportunity like this, and yet it was so clear to us, we felt like we had to walk through that door and do it.
When God closes the door, He opens a window, they say. To which I answer, is it really that simple? Hi, Bram Floria here with Compassion Radio, the daily journal of God's intrepid people who keep finding ways to be at the center of the action, and not because they're adrenaline junkies. No, the kind of people you'll often hear from on this program are much more thoughtful and selfless than that. Today's guest, for example. In a year where so much seems to still be falling apart around the world, there are some incredible, missions-minded, and talented aviators that counted the cost and literally said, here am I, send me. And because of what they do, you'll literally get the 30,000-foot view of the kingdom of God in the 2020s. Thanks for joining us today.
It's been a few years since I've had our guest today back on Compassion Radio. Dan Whitehead, now the operations director at MAF, which is Mission Aviation Fellowship. Welcome back to Compassion Radio.
Thanks, Bram.
When we first talked on Compassion Radio, we talked about relationships and about married life and missions work and stuff. It was kind of a general overview. What's it like to be married on the mission field, really doing cutting-edge missions work? Because you, at the time, were still very active in South America.
Yeah, so we lived 27 years in Central and South America, raised our family there, you know, did life there, and it was great.
You ended up inheriting, too, one of the most sainted seats in all the Christian missions because of its familiarity with the evangelical world here in America. And that was the station in Ecuador that actually sent the missionaries in to reach the Auca Indians back in the 1950s and the incredible stories that ended up becoming almost novelized. There's a mythology that goes along with that, how great the sacrifice was and how well documented even by the mainstream media at the time in Life magazine. And you ran the base, ran the hangar, flew from the same strip that Nate Saint flew from when he took those missionaries into the Alca territories. And you spent a lot of years there in his shadow some ways, but it's a whole new generation, of course.
Right.
What did you learn from actually being in the footsteps, the literal footsteps of people who had given their lives in missions?
I think one of the things I learned, or one of the things that surprised me when we moved to Ecuador, and we were there for our last 13 years on the field, was how powerful that story was.
Yeah.
I had heard the story, of course, because Jungle Pilot was the book that I read that inspired me to think about becoming a mission aviator. And so I had heard the story. But when we actually moved to Shell, and literally our house was 50 steps away from the old Nate Saint house, and people started showing up at my door and saying, hey, can we go look in the house? Can we take a look at the house? And telling me their stories, you know, these were people who were inspired like me to go into missions or to go or to become pastors or to dedicate their lives to ministry because of the story they had heard about the five guys who gave their
lives. Stories have the power not just to motivate us or make us think differently, but to actually get in motion and do things and go places they never would have gone. Yeah. The power of that narrative is there. Why is that particular story, you think, so motivational for people even today?
I think because it represents the fact that once God gets a hold of your life and once you understand the truth of the gospel, that becomes everything for you. Yeah. And that's what these guys did. And they went to a place that for many Americans at that time was the end of the earth.
Yeah.
And were doing things that most Americans would consider very difficult. And, you know, why would you give up the nice life of, you know, the United States in the 50s and 60s? Why would you go do that? And yet these guys were saying, well, there's a really compelling reason, you know, that we're doing this. As you read back and read what some of those guys wrote, Jim Elliott and even Nate wrote some really interesting stuff in their journals and in their books that showed the depth of that relationship that they had with God. And, you know, people read that and they go, okay, there was something different, you know, going on here.
I know you guys have many great pictures over the years of your pilots looking out through their cockpits and seeing territories that are not reached for the gospel It's simply by their very presence. Being on those wings, flying over those ridges, means a new pathway for the gospel to reach people he's never in this century or even millennium ever reached. You get to be first eyes on the site that God is already looking down and saying, I have my people there. I'm going to bring you to them. You're going to build my kingdom there. It's a marvelous picture. I see many of those kind of horizon shots that show up in your materials over the years. That over-the-horizon view was something that inspired our ministry, as you know, because Norm Nelson, my predecessor, and his father, Wilbur Nelson, were very active with the Saint family. And in fact, one of the last joyrides that Nate did before he headed south to go down to Ecuador on that fateful journey was to take Norm Nelson up in his plane and fly him around. He got to see Los Angeles. He got to see over the top of those mountains into the desert valleys beyond. It was a total perspective changer for him, having grown up in that valley in California. And he always remembered that vision of being able to see over the mountains to the next thing. It never left him. And it traveled with him everywhere he went, from Afghanistan to Haiti to all the central China provinces. I think all his years, he always thought about that encounter with what's beyond the horizon as being something that God could see.
Yeah, that's cool.
And you, obviously, are not just the inheritor of a legacy and therefore trying to maintain a legacy. You are working hard to expand the reach and in this century do something that MAF wasn't even able to do in the last century. Tell me a little bit about your position now and what the challenges and what the opportunities are for aviation fellowship around the world.
Yeah, so I took the position here at our headquarters as the chief operations officer about 3 years ago now. It's probably taken me about 3 years to figure out what the job really means and to get the new perspective that I needed after so many years in one specific part of the world, now to see things on a broader scale and a broader level. MAF has always talked about the fact that we want to help reach isolated people for Christ. And isolation comes in many forms, right? There's geographical isolation, to be sure, but there's also political isolation and social isolation and many other things. And so I'm seeing MAF moving into a time when we could be broadening what we do in some really interesting ways. And for example, we operate in an unnamed location, a flight school. It's in the middle of a big city. It's not a geographically isolated area, but it is very isolated in that it's a restricted access nation. Christians aren't welcome there generally. And yet, because of the platform of aviation, we're able to have our staff there working with young people, teaching aviation skills.
And you have favor from the authorities to be doing that.
Exactly. In fact, they invited us in. They had seen us working in a neighboring country and asked us if we could come do something similar. And so that platform allowed us to do something that was different. And we're looking at more things like that. Can we start preparing people, for example, for a career in aviation? Not just flying with MAF, but let's say we could put a pilot in a cockpit of an airline from a restricted access nation. And we can figure out how to prepare that person to be in that place and use that
to mentor the next generation.
Exactly. Yeah.
Is it always just a bucket of fire every time you step into this job? Now, every day you open your email and find out there's something new you got to put out around the world. Or is it just a joy for you to step in and say, where is God at work today anywhere in the world?
I think it's both things. And certainly in today's world, incredible things are happening all over the place. And you know, anybody that looks at the news sees all the things that are happening, from natural disasters to political strife to all of those different things. So certainly that is part of it. But also, as I go and travel and visit my staff and see people around the world, every time I'm encouraged. I mean, I'm always just like, wow, this is great that God allows us to do this in this place and have this kind of impact. That's just a blessing. So I love that part of it.
And having had a tenure out there on the field for so many years, I imagine you're fairly unflappable at this point. You've seen a lot of stuff. And with your history being there, with Nate's sacrifice on the field, I imagine all of your pilots throughout all those decades since have probably said, it's not as bad as what those guys faced. Yeah. I'm not being killed for my faith on a beach somewhere in the middle of the Ecuador jungle. So I can make it through today because it's not as bad as that. As simple as that math might be on a napkin. But there's more about that. It encourages us and invigorates us to say, if it came to that, it would be okay.
Exactly.
And that God's work continues. And even if I have to leave my blood on this soil, God has not failed and the church has not failed. His kingdom will live forever.
Exactly. One of the great things that happened, or that I got to witness as a result of Nate and the other guy's sacrifice, Nate's old house there in Shell has been remodeled, mm-hmm. and it's now a meeting place. There's an apartment in there, and there's a little museum in there. And as I was walking by that house one day, I could hear voices in Warani, in the Auca language. Those guys were in there singing praise songs. And I looked in the window, and sure enough, the little Warani church that meets in Shell was having a special event. They got too many people to fit in their little church, and so they brought everybody over to the Saint House and asked if they could use the big meeting room. And I thought, wow, only God does that, you know, where the guy who built this house was killed by these folks' ancestors, and now these people are meeting in his home, singing praises to the God that he was trying to serve. So it's a neat story.
In God's economy, he's kind enough to us to let us witness those things from time to time. But that does not mean that just because we didn't see it, that God's not up to those kind of things everywhere we go.
Yeah, that's true.
And I imagine you probably have hints of things, but can't really prove them in places you go, that you heard a rumor of God did something good here, or these people have come to life in the Spirit, or you see the Spirit at work in the people, or things change politically. You suddenly find favor with people who are anti the work of the kingdom in those countries, and you don't know how it happened.
Yeah.
You never can really tell when God's going to turn the spigot on of his grace and his blessing and pave the way for you. And sometimes you're probably surprised, why did that shut off so suddenly?
Right.
The thing we were counting on is now no longer open to us.
Yeah.
What do you guys do, or what do you do for your guys now from your position in leadership and authority back here in the States, too, when the unexpected happens badly? When something shuts down hard and you believe that God had that opportunity or that pathway to build his kingdom and it's suddenly gone.
Yeah. Well, you alluded to it a moment ago when you talked about the fact that, you know, our folks have counted the cost to a certain extent. They've made a decision to serve with us and they know that that could possibly mean, you know, something bad might happen. And we do spend a fair amount of time with them as they go through the candidacy and orientation process and talk about a theology of suffering, theology of loss, and some of those kind of things so that they understand that. But when that does happen, we try to be prepared. Yeah. We believe that God doesn't want us to just be crazy, you know, when we go out there. And so we have contingency plans. We have security plans. We have trigger points. We have all of these things in place because we feel like we should be wise about what we're doing. And so when things get to a certain point, we will say, all right, we need to go. You know, it's not safe to continue on. And we'll make those decisions. Sometimes you don't have that option. I mean, sometimes things happen or escalate so fast that bad things happen.
Friends, before we jump back to today's interview, I just want to remind you that Compassion Radio is a communications ministry, and it depends on the faithful support of you to keep bringing inspiring stories to the air each day. Our vision partners support us monthly with gifts large and small and make it possible for us to take you to the very front lines of faith. Whether you join our vision team or make a one-time gift, thank you for believing in and standing by this ministry. We're here to bring you real good news in every situation. Just call us at 1-800-868-2478 to make your gift. You can also text the word compassion to 53445 to give right through your phone, or visit our website, compassionradio.com. Thank you, friends, for everything you've done and what you'll do today. We love you. And now, back to the interview.
Sometimes things happen or escalate so fast that bad things happen. Okay. And that's always a possibility.
Let's talk about that then. One of the reasons we're sitting down to have this conversation this week is because you are active in two areas of the world that have been absolutely hammered by events. Literally, Afghanistan and Haiti. Help me out to understand what God is doing in Afghanistan and how you responded as a leader and an operations director when the Taliban didn't just sweep through the country, that everything else around them just crumbled. It doesn't seem like people even put up a fight to let the Taliban sweep back in and reclaim their previous post of controlling that nation. And you had people. Tell me about this.
Yeah, so we are working in South Central Asia, and it's a restricted access country, and we are doing aviation ministry there. And there's been a lot of turmoil there and struggle there, and we've just recently had to move our people out. But our hope is that we can go back in. So we've been operating for a long time. We were operating when the Taliban was in control the first time around. We operate as a humanitarian organization. Mm-hmm. We're there to help people. We serve a lot of like-minded people there, but we also serve a lot of NGOs that wouldn't necessarily be Christian in their work. So same thing. Our folks who go feel the call to go to a place like that. they understand the risks of it. They go with their families, and they have great ministries. Most of our national staff there would not be believers. They go with that in mind. And this week, when everything kind of went south, it was a very difficult decision for them, actually.
Do you ride this one out, or do you step aside for a while?
Right. And, you know, we, in kind of a group of counselors, you know, made the decision that, yeah, we do need to leave this time. And so we asked our staff to leave. It's bittersweet for them.
Yeah.
They do want their families to be safe, but they also have their national friends who they know can't leave.
And they want them to be safe.
Exactly.
Too. Yeah. Okay. And we can't talk operationally about where they've gone since or what the operation plans are to stage things or move things, assets around, including planes and people. But you are praying daily about the strategic vision. What does God have for you to be able to prepare for what's next? Because it is a linchpin, a fulcrum of Asia.
Mm-hmm.
It's a huge territory that has very few people in it, except for those spots where the cities are massive.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of territory to cover. I imagine when your people fly, especially in Central Asia, they have to really plan well for their fuel management. Those are long flights, I imagine.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll certainly be looking at what we can do. We do have a base of operations in a neighboring country, and so we'll be there for the time being. But yeah, our hope at this moment is that as politically things settle down, we'll be able to reevaluate, and we still have lots of friends. We still have lots of contacts, and should whatever government forms out of this issues an invitation for us to come back and help, we'll be ready to go back and help.
And that means being able and willing to work with people that other people on other persuasions or other occupations or in politics would say, never talk to these people.
Yeah.
You have gone to places and loved people and died for people that everyone else would say are lost. They're not worth saving. Even the church has come against you at times saying, don't bother with these. And yet, you know, the Holy Spirit said, you must go. If you're going to follow me, this is where I'm going. Mm-hmm. How do you deal with the naysayers out there that think you're foolish for stepping into something that seems a waste of energy and resources and lives?
I don't get a lot of that kind of pushback. I would say probably folks higher up in the mission get more of that than I do. The folks that call in and say, hey, what are you guys doing? Hey, it sounds like you're doing crazy stuff. But I think we're generally able to say to those folks, this is what we believe God has asked us to do. He's made the way clear. He's opened doors. We may not have even been looking for an opportunity like this. And yet it was so clear to us that we felt like we had to walk through that door and do it. We're going to be careful to not drift from our mission. We don't want to become, you know, one of those other Christian organizations that became something different. So we're guarding against that. We continually say our mission, although we use aviation, it's a technical mission, but our vision is to see people everywhere have a chance to know Jesus. And that's what we want to do.
And in pursuit of that mission, you have absolutely the kind of work ethic that we've been preaching on for the past 30 years ourselves, and we admire in every agency that we see out there. That when we see people like Mission Aviation Fellowship, where the person they meet is not a project, they're not an objective, they're not a pawn on their map for world conquest, but they see the people they encounter as loved by God, and therefore, we should love them, period. Whether they ever agree with us or not, whether they ever come to our church and darken our door or not, that we have to be the church out there because there's so few churches to even be part of.
Right.
So you guys and gals know when they enter into an airspace, into a village, they are the church. They are the kingdom outpost. And so they better represent well.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And in fact, we one of the phrases we've used a lot in our mission is first-person witness. And we kind of had to emphasize that because in our history, we were very much a service organization. Mm-hmm. We served the folks who were the frontline people. But now in some of these restricted access nations, it really is us. We're the ones who need to be the witness. And
that doesn't mean to be the preach.
No, not at all. No.
So give me an example for the years that you spent in the air, a lot of it in South America. How did you pray when you took off, and what did you see God change in your perspective about what you were about moving into this first-person witness mentality?
Yeah, you know, I started in Central America. We were there a short time, but then we went to Venezuela, and I was there for a long time. And we served basically in a very traditional way. We served missionaries that were working out deep in the jungle. We flew their stuff, flew them. I worked, obviously, on a Christian team of MAFers, and it was very much a little bit of a bubble, you know? When we moved over to Ecuador, I moved into a program that was in the midst of transitioning to becoming a nationally run entity, so run by the local believers there in Ecuador. And in order for them to do that financially, they didn't have the benefit of the dollars that came from Western missionaries and all of that. And so they said, we need to have a different model. And part of that model was doing some commercial work. And so we did commercial flights. We had a maintenance shop where we worked on other people's airplanes. And I became the director of that maintenance shop for a while. And it was great because I had these other guys coming from other aviation operations sitting in my office to talk to me about getting their plane fixed. But almost always there was opportunities for me to talk to them about something spiritually related. I mean, you know, we had Bible verses on our wall and everything else. And eventually they would go, so what's up with you guys? You know, why is this a maintenance shop or a church or what is it? You know?
Yes.
Yeah. And so you had the opportunity to talk to these guys, you know, and I thought, well, this is ministry, you know, and somebody could easily say, well, we have these commercial flights and then we have these ministry flights. And I came to the place where I went, you know what? They're all ministry flights.
Amen. And again, not because you're making projects out of people.
Right.
You're not a multi-level marketing organization. This is the kingdom. The kingdom already exists and it has its people. And God knows who he's calling to places where they're going to know him personally in deep ways. And he knows how he's going to go about transforming this world and its history and its systems to where it finally bends the needle toward the gospel as something that is world inhabiting. So we are in that breach between the old sin system and the new renewed system. You have a redemptive worldview, so you're thrilled to be in this chapter, in this phase of God's plan. You're not afraid of it. You're not worried about what the politics might do there and yonder. You're just in it. Yeah. And you know, God has dropped you and I in this generation for some reason. As I understand it, you're pretty much a salt of the earth, Midlands kind of guy. You were raised in Iowa. Mm-hmm. And you have Quaker roots, too. I know your dad's worshiping in that church. Mm-hmm. Tell me about someone who has been so simple in their piety, which is what the Quaker tradition was like, suddenly capturing a view of the world again.
I wish that for almost everybody, that everybody could have the kind of experiences I've been able to have. Because as you travel, and you know this because you've done it, your worldview gets broadened. You begin to understand things that you never would have grasped before just because you can see it. And I would wish that for everybody. One of the things that we always loved about being on the mission field was we served with people from lots of different church traditions, you know, from Pentecostal all the way to Episcopalian and everything in between. And when you're on the mission field, you need each other, right? Mm-hmm. The body is a little bit smaller and you don't really emphasize too much traditions, worship styles, all of those kind of things.
The culture of your church.
Right. And you find, hey, I'm just in this body of believers and we need each other and we take care of each other. And, you know, that was a great thing for me to see because in the U.S., we can very quickly get drawn into our camps of, you know, this denomination or that denomination or whatever. Yeah. And on the mission field, that just really wasn't an issue.
You know, I noticed too, when I travel, especially in regions of the world where I have so little commonality in upbringing, how you treat your children, how they learn, how they grow, the kind of questions they ask, the kind of games you play, the places you go for entertainment. Where do you go to get, you know, a meal or a gallon of gas for your car? I don't know in this culture, so I don't recognize it. But I noticed that I seem to recognize the kingdom.
Yeah.
That when you walk into the room and say, oh, these are God's people. Yeah. You kind of knew it. The Spirit was saying, my people, go sit with them. And so you sat down and relaxed in those situations and just realized, God's got this. And he has his own culture that's not just about my denominational culture back home in America.
Yeah.
How did you discover what the kingdom was like when you went out there? And how did you know that you were in the presence of God's people?
Yeah, I think the first time it hit me really hard was in a village called Mahuana in Venezuela. It was a village that had had missionaries there for several years. The first time I landed there, they didn't know me. but yet the kindness and love that I felt as I stepped out of the airplane was palpable. I mean, I was just like, this is a great place. You know, this place, it's light, you know. There was a village not 5 minutes flight time away that was completely the opposite. I mean, you could feel it. When you got out of the plane in that village, it felt dark. And in fact, I was forced to overnight in that village one time, and there was no hospitality. they, you know, no one offered me a place to sleep. No one offered anything. I slept in the airplane, and you could just feel the difference.
Yeah.
And I can only attribute that to the Holy Spirit. you know, that's what the difference was in those two villages.
The whole Man of Peace principle, when you find someone that will bring you in and show you godly hospitality, mm-hmm. God says, I've got a plan here.
The rest of this powerful interview with Dan Whitehead of MAF is coming up tomorrow, so I hope you'll tune in then. There is so much to be thankful for, even in hard times. Right now, I'm very thankful for you. Your gift of time each day is a genuine treasure to us. Knowing that you're being challenged to live out your faith like never before is a wonderful encouragement to us as well. I hope you'll take time today to drop us a note through our website or by email. You can reach me directly at the following address, bramfloria@compassionradio.com. However you reach out, know that we're in this ministry and this work for you and because of you. Just call or write us today to help keep us on the air and in the field. Call 1-800-868-2478. Our mailing address is P.O. Box 2770, Orange, California, 92859. And jump in anytime at CompassionRadio.com. We're waiting for you, friends. Hop on board.